Welcome back, everyone, to Family Matters. And this evening, we have on with us Rabbi Dr. Bencion Twersky. I want to welcome you, Rabbi Twersky.
It's wonderful to be here.
So, Rabbi Dr. Twersky, it's been 20 years that we've been talking about teens at risk. Mass calls it teens in conflict. You have been running a facilitating a support group for parents from the first day that mass began. And we just celebrated in February our 20th year with over 45,000 families that we've spoken to, referred to, had group for them different over the years with different therapists. And I want to thank you publicly for always being there for mass parents, making yourself available, facilitating the groups every Wednesday night so consistently all the years. And I'd like to talk this evening about the different trends, how things evolved, how they changed from 20 years ago to today. So, Rabbi Dr. Twersky, can I address you as Dr. Twersky alone? Is that all right, please?
Whatever titles you like.
Thank you. So, Dr. Twersky, can you talk about what you saw 20 years ago when we started MASC and how things changed over the years, please?
Certain things have changed. Certain things are still very much the same. Let's describe the average parent from 20 years ago when MASC first got its first meetings going. What was typical at that point was parents in. We were hearing more often than not about kids from the upper ages, the upper teens. Not that we never heard of younger ones. We were hearing about the upper teens. Probably for the first year or so of the meetings, the parents coming in, by and large, were divorced mothers. And it was, I don't know if this was a statistical trend, whether it represented the whole population out there of all the cases, but the ones reaching out and not reaching out, screaming out, they were yelling, "Can I get some help?" were situations in which the kids were faced with home situations that were challenging because of single parent families and all the various issues related to that. And when you add to that the fact that those kinds of issues spill over into every other environment where the kids are found, including schools and communities, there was a lot of difficulty going on. Kids were unhappy. They were miserable. They were running away. They were running away from home. They were running away from schools. They were trying to extricate themselves from the communities, even extended families as well. Now, parents were in absolute shock. What do we do? How do we manage this? Among the messages that were out there at the time were I'm sitting here listening to them talk, listening to them share. We're talking about a group where people are sharing their own stories in front of peers, other parents of similar kinds of teens, and what they're talking about is how they have to set boundaries, they have to set limits. Now, I will tell you that children who have limits, children of all ages, who have boundaries and have limits, are happier than the ones that don't. Look, you drive on a highway. I'm much more comfortable on a highway that has those guardrails on each side, rather than, it's completely open on the shoulder. You don't know where it's going to go if you have to pull over. We need boundaries and we need limits. But parents were struggling. Now, wait a second. My kid's coming home in the middle of the night. I want my kid home at 10 o'clock, you know? Or why is my kid going out altogether? And what they were doing is following a concept that was out there, quite popular at the time, called tough love. And what that meant was, you got to tell your kid, I love you, but you better be home at 10 o'clock. And the messages that the kids were getting was not, I love you and I want you to be safe, which I'm sure every parent feels that. But the message they were giving was, you better be home on time or I'm going to lock you out.
I remember those days.
You remember those days?
The parents were really struggling. There were a bunch of single moms, and they were really, really struggling, not knowing what to do and how to do it. And I remember that one person came to me. I remember meeting them on the street, and they said, why are you hanging out the dirty laundry from Jews? Why are you starting an organization named MASK? Why are you talking about taking off our mask of a community or the mask of denial? And I remember saying to them that when I started it, there were 27 mothers that showed up to the first meeting, and we went out to see, are there any families that should have been at the meeting? And I remember that we came up with a list of over 150 names of parents that kids were struggling. And that's what I came to talk to you about 20 years ago, that if there are 150 kids out there struggling, in 3 months, there may be, God forbid, 300 kids. And I remember you saying, let's deal with it now. Let's deal with what we have and make sure that these parents at least try their best in getting their kids the help they need. And then let's reach out to the community. So, Dr. Tversky, what is it that changed from then, from those days, the tough love? What do you see has evolved over the years?
You know, when you raise the label tough love, I very often sit back and say, gosh, you know, that I wasn't even upset about tough love. I was wording it differently. I was calling it love tough, and I think that, you know, putting the love before the tough was a useful message. But even with that, at the end of the day, our kids are running away from us. The kids are escaping. They're looking for higher ground. Trying to pull them back by being tough on them is just adding more rejection. That's not what we're looking to do. We have to recognize that a kid that's in a matzav like this is what halacha would refer to, and I've heard many paiskim say this openly, chayla sheyesh bai sakana. He is a sick individual, a sick child who is in danger. And the halachas for chayla sheyesh bai sakana, there are a lot of times where we have to say, wait a second, you're right, normally, under normal circumstances, you couldn't or shouldn't do such and such. The situation here is different. Look, no Shomer Shabbos family is going to be pleased to have a child at home that's not keeping Shabbos. How many people have had to bite their lip and tolerate a kid who comes to the Shabbos table not dressed appropriately? It's angering. I understand that. I can recognize it. But the choice that we're making is, do I want to allow that child to be accepted here and to eventually have a bridge by which they can come back? Or do I want to banish the kid completely? You know, there's even a very spiritual way to phrase this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to treat us mida keneged mida. And if we will be rejecting of our children who are struggling and they're misbehaving, whatever they're up to, if we're going to reject them, then when we recognize that we are not at the spiritual level that we should be, right? Just because ain't tzaddik ba'aretz, there's nobody who's a complete tzaddik who hasn't violated something. I don't want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to banish me. And you know what? We have to treat our children the way we want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to treat us. And I would want to be able to be as accepting and loving of my children as I possibly can. For me to take on the stand, no child of mine is going to do this, or which, by the way, calls to another issue completely. When I raise my child, my obligation, this is why my child was given to me, is to raise the child according to his derech, according to his needs, not according to mine. If I discipline my child because I'm angry and I have to release my anger, I'm doing a disservice to that child. I need to give him the type of chinuch that's going to help him grow and to be the best he can. Not the best that I want, the best that he can. It's wonderful if I'm going to have nachas from it because I enjoy it. But that's not why he is given to me. That child is given to me for me to help him develop in the best way that he can. And if he is not going to be exactly as I would have wished him to be, right, it's not up to what I wished him to be. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from him? And you know what? I can't profess to have the kind of Ruach HaKodesh to know exactly what was destined for him. So I have to give him the things that allow him to develop himself, whether it's scholastically, whether professionally, whether it's anything else. You know, I enjoyed watching over the years how there are many of these kids that have decided to take up various forms of martial arts. Now, I happen to be incredibly ignorant about the entire field. I know nothing. You can start to give me the names of the different forms of martial arts. I'm completely in the dark about any of them. I don't know the difference. What I do know is that in martial arts, there's a tremendous amount of training about how to build character and how to build a system of how you do certain things and follow certain rules. Do you know what? Those methods teach discipline, self-discipline, a lot better than our schools do. Now, I'm not going to tell you content-wise that that's what I would idealize, but I'm not resistant when I hear somebody who's going to whatever. They're taking various kinds of classes in this. Yeah, might it help them if they get on the street and they're in a bad place at the wrong time? I'm not even thinking about it that way. I want them to be disciplined kids, and unfortunately, our yeshivas are not great with that. I need to be mechanech my child according to my child's needs, not according to my own. And parents have been struggling with this. And that used to come in at the very, very beginning, the first mass meetings. Parents would say, but my kid has to dress like this. My kid can't wear jeans. My kid can't wear this kind of a shirt. And, you know, and his yarmulke has to look like this or that. And this kind of, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And today, Baruch Hashem, more parents see that when they try that, it fails. And they're looking for now what's going to be more successful.
Right. I remember those days. Boy, oh boy. Wow, you bring me back so many years ago. And I remember when parents were struggling with the clothes, no jeans or whatever they were struggling with. And I must say, you mentioned the yeshivas. They really deserve a big yesh koach for the positive things they are doing, that they are learning, that therapists. They're accepting therapists in the schools more and more. They're accepting social workers, psychologists. They're reaching out for assistance and staff training to MASC and many other organizations for trainings. They've definitely come a long way since I began MASC 20 years ago. And yes, they still have a long way to go in reference to that child that is a square that needs to fit into the round. I mean, what did Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson spoke about? Did you see that? Did you listen to his tape about the schools?
Yes.
So do you want to elaborate on what he spoke about and how we really still need to address that and work towards getting that child that can't do well in the school, not throwing them out of the school, not hurting them, not killing them, not putting a real end-of-life situations to so many of these kids that get asked to leave? Or after just today on our helpline, a mom called. Her daughter graduated eighth grade, and she has learning disabilities, went through first to eighth grade, and now they say, we can't accept you in ninth grade in our high school. That is devastation to a child when they're asked not to come back. So can you elaborate on the Y.Y. Jacobson, Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson's video, and also on the issue of kids getting kicked out of yeshivas?
Let's put something into very, very general, a general statement. You know, over these past many years, there have been probably many dozens of articles and discussions that have gone on in all sorts of public forums, be it on in our magazines and media and blogs and wherever. And there are multiple efforts that people have made to try to say, oh, the kids are OTD because of, and they talk about, you know, rules in school, or they talk about it's the fault of the internet. Well, guess what? There were OTD kids before computers were here. So that, you know, I had a classmate in yeshiva with me, and we're talking 50 years ago, who was smoking marijuana. You know, now he was in yeshiva. He was compliant. He was doing what he had to do, so he never got thrown out. I have no idea what was done about this situation then. But all this OTD stuff has existed long before many of the causes that anybody's talking about. I will tell you that I believe very, very strongly that there is one ingredient which comes in many different forms, but if you just conceptualize it, that is responsible for, I believe, 100% of all the cases that we have of kids that are struggling, whatever your label is, at risk in the parsha, kids in pain, whatever. And the word is rejection. And rejection can come in many forms. Rejection can come in the form of a child being singled out, or a child being punished, or being embarrassed. We do not have the right to shame our children, whether it's at home or in schools. We have no such right to do it. Punishment has to be something that is educational, not something that allows whoever the authority figure is to take revenge against somebody who violated something. Breaking rules is not a reason for punishment. It's a reason for teaching. Chinuch and discipline have very, very little area of overlap. True chinuch teaches. True chinuch doesn't punish. There's a place for punishment, but it occupies very, very little space. Discipline produces compliance. Education produces growth. Our mission as mechanchim, and I mean mechanchim both in the school sense as well as in the family sense, is to help our children grow. Will a negative consequence to a child help that kid grow? Well, guess what? If it doesn't, you've basically taken the kid and said to that child, you don't matter. And rejection has a serious negative consequence. When we get rejected, we run. Well, our kids do too. And unfortunately, when our kids run, they're running away from our family, from our derech, from Yiddishkeit, from whatever. And it's frightening because it's not good for them either. They're running because there's too much pain over here. They've been rejected. Now, again, it happens in many different forms. It happens in how the discipline is delivered. It happens with kids not being accepted. It happens with kids being thrown out or being suspended unfairly. You know, several years ago, I began searching online to find yeshivas who would discuss, who had links in their websites for rules for the schools. I found an interesting one. It's a very frum school. I'm not going to describe it with any detail. And on the admissions tab, besides application forms and stuff to fill out, there was a document that was referred to as reward and discipline policy. And it was basically close to 4 pages, a little paragraph at the beginning introducing the need for having rules. It broke the rules, the policy, into several different sections. And each one of them basically said, this is what will qualify to throw your kid out. So they break this rule, they get suspended for 1 day or 3 days, they do it a second time, then this. And it basically said after a certain number of violations, expulsion. And somewhere at the very end, there was one little paragraph about, and if your kid behaves, he can go into a raffle to be a student of the month. And I looked at this, I said, somebody's got rocks in their head. You spend 3.5 pages telling me how you're going to justify throwing my kid out, and one little paragraph about how you're going to about how you're going to give him something that's positive. Is that where we're at? So that we're looking at, if we recognize expulsion is rejection, we have to think about it twice. Now, you know what? We've all listened to this, and we've heard this in the mask office and at meetings a lot, where the justification for expulsion, sometimes from the family, is this kid is going to ruin everybody else.
That's a real question that schools always respond when we ask them to work with kids, young adults, elementary age, high school age, girls and boys. They say that, you know, maybe it'll affect other kids in the class. They share things that are inappropriate. They talk about things that the school doesn't allow, whatever it may be. What is your response to that?
Do you remember when Mask had sibling group?
Which group?
The group for the siblings of the...
The sibling group. A wonderful now, sibling group, just for our audience.
Okay.
I'd like everyone to know that this evening we have Rabbi Dr. Ben-Zion Twersky with us, who's been facilitating one of the several groups that MASC has weekly for the last 20 years. And Dr. Twersky is addressing now the issues of girls and boys being asked to leave school due to learning disabilities, behaviors, and he is discussing the last 20 years working with MASC. And yes, Dr. Twersky, you just brought up the sibling groups that MASC has had For the siblings of family members that are struggling. Our number is 718-758-0400. You can call MASC from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. anonymously. Describe your situation, your question. MASC is a referral agency. We offer support groups for parents. We're in the yeshivas. We do community awareness programs. And we have interns that are dealing with the parents through PTA and staff trainings. Call MASC. Take the number down, 718-758-0400. Maybe you need it for yourself, a loved one, a child, or someone that you sit next to in shul may need it. Give them our number. Let them call us. It's a confidential helpline from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And now we're back with you, Dr. Tversky. You were saying about the sibling support groups. Yes.
No, there's no question. I mean, the calling at the point in time when the sibling groups began had a lot to do with how one child acting out would have an impact on the siblings. But that was as I recall, it was not because everybody saw that the siblings were at risk of following in their brother sister's footsteps, but it was more that, you know, there was all the energy of the family was focusing on one kid who was acting out, and how do you cope with a sibling that's acting out that way. Those were the kinds of things happening at the time. The reality is that the fear that many parents were talking about at the meetings here, and I'm sure that this was voiced at many of the other meetings, is if one kid starts acting out, there's a domino effect, and other kids from the family are going to begin doing that, which is just a parallel to the fear that yeshivas are voicing all the time, that we are not interested in helping this child. We have to get this child out of the school because he or she is going to have a negative impact and take other kids down with them. Now, what's unfortunate is that this attitude is being taken without the data to back it up. I've been asking, can you show me a child in yeshiva that was taken down by somebody else? Can't say it never happened, but it's very, very uncommon. What tends to happen is that a kid acts out, is embarrassed to share that with his peers, and does the thing, her thing, pretty much on the side. Their allegiances and alliances with other friends and peers who are similarly acting out tends not to happen within the schools. And again, I'm not saying it never does. I'm sure somebody could call in and say, yes, it happened with my kid. I'm sure that can happen. It's the exception. It's not the rule. So what we have now are kids who are being seen as perpetrators of damaging a class full, and they're really of no threat whatsoever. They're struggling, and they need help, but instead of helping them, what we're doing is we're rejecting them and giving them ever more reason why to keep following the negative pathways. So this is something that I've been facing many, many, many times here. And parents struggle with this. And you know what? Parents can be as accepting as they want to be, but if there's rejection coming everywhere else, the continued rejection keeps the kids exactly where they are and keeps them going further in the directions. That's the struggle that we have now, where the kids are being kept away in so many different fronts. And here we're trying to hold on to them. A big change that has happened over these last 20 years is that parents are much more apt today than they were 20 years ago to say, I want to hold on to my kid. And that having them to be more accepting, yes, the kid is not going to be looking at the Shabbos table the way that you would want him or her to look. That is true. The kid may be walking to the table with piercings. They might. They might do that. But I would rather that they be with their piercings at the Shabbos table than being at a bar in another part of town meeting up with God knows who and doing God knows what. And to the degree that we can do that kind of kiruv to our own children, right? And I mean, when I mean our own children, I mean this both in terms of schools as well as families. We stand the chance of them coming back, a reasonable chance of them coming back. We have a greater chance that they're going to actually go for help to deal with whatever the issues were. You know, if the rejection stops and acceptance starts, you've taken that first step. And it's critical. It's critical for the kids that they be accepted where they go. I remember years ago, some of the people in the field working with the kids were trying to insist, if one of these kids walks into shul, give him galila, call him up to the Sefer Torah. Don't reject him just because he's coming in and he's not looking the way that you would want him to look. Accept him. Reach out to him. You have no idea what one act of acceptance does. I've watched
yes,
family
today
after
really
family.
Changed. Today it's really changed. I know that in my neighborhood where I live, they're very, very accepting, and it's so wonderful to see. I remember when I started MASK, the kids were hanging out on Ocean Parkway and Avenue L, and I remember they were at Mechallel Shabbos, they were drugging, they're drinking there publicly Friday night, all day Shabbos, and people were very angry and stayed away from them, and today it's changed. People are engaging with them. They are putting their arms around these people, these kids, and welcoming them in to the community, to the shul. They are greeting them on the street. And that has changed and makes a huge difference in these young adults' minds. They do feel more accepted around communities. Not all, Rabbi Twersky, Dr. Twersky, not all, but there has been a shift, and it's definitely trickling down to the kids on the street, that they know that they're not, being thrown out by the community. They're definitely feeling the love more in the communities, in Borough Park, in Flatbush, in Crown Heights, in the Five Towns, and other communities as well. There's still a lot more work to do. Yes, but
can I add one thing? I think that when you say that, I think that you need to recognize that as one of the leading organizations in this field, MASK has taken a very, very important role. I'm not going to give MASK 100% credit for it because there have been a lot of other tzaddikim and tzidkanias out there doing terrific, terrific work.
Absolutely.
MASK has been very much of a leadership organization.
There are many organizations, I'm going to interrupt you and agree with you and piggyback on what you're saying, that Yasher Koach, all the organizations out there that have come to the front lines where MASK has been all these years, and we're aligned with them doing the same thing for the Klal. There's so many choices today, and anybody interested in reaching any of those organizations, feel free to call 718-758-0400 and we will refer you to those organizations. There are many organizations and outpatient clinics that are dealing with these youth today and these young adults and marrieds that have gambling issues, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, whatever it is, sex addiction. There are many organizations and askanim rabbis in the community that and professionals that are dealing with this and are available. And anyone that wants to reach Rabbi Dr. Torsky, you can call 718-437-4118 to reach Dr. Torsky. Dr. Torsky, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
There's a very valuable point that we need to add, and this is taking a little bit of a historical perspective, but I think that it's useful, and that is that over the years we've watched not just the trends in how parents are behaving and dealing with situations like this, but we've also watched the trends of what kinds of the situations are going on with the kids change. For instance, when MASC was starting, yes, we heard of all kinds of drugs being used, but the kinds of drugs that were popular then are not necessarily the same drugs that are popular now, and the fluctuations over these years have followed trends that either they were parallel to what went on in the non-Jewish world. Maybe they were not. But it follows different patterns. Back in the day, the big drug that we were worried about was ecstasy. I haven't even heard a case of ecstasy in my office for years. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not out there. I'm sure that there are many cases over there. I'm not sure. I'm sure that many of these cases go to some of the outpatient centers and are not coming to me. But what I'm saying is that there have been trends over the years, and that having organizations that are in the forefront, we get this information and we're able to actually adjust what we do to deal with the problems that are going on in the street now. You know, many of the situations that existed for our kids 20 years ago are not there today. They're very different today. Right? Today, the marijuana has in many aspects, in many many places, is legal. Recreational marijuana is not treated as a legal issue. Now, you ask me as a professional,
Dr. Torsky, that's very confusing for the youth, for the young adults today. It is very confusing. How could it
horrible.
Be legal and okay, and why isn't it good for me?
And my issue is, I'm not coming at this from the legal angle, because that's not what my focus is. My focus is on these behaviors are self-destructive, right? Alcohol is legal, but it can be used in a way that's self-destructive. We have a serious problem with it. With marijuana, it's self-destructive. I don't want to be driving on the highway when there's somebody near me who's under the influence. And it was legal for him to have it. It puts me in danger. It puts them into a very dangerous place. And it's something that we have to be very, very careful with. So that, you know, I have a zero tolerance. My tendency to have zero tolerance has not changed over all the years. I don't care what Albany said.
I'm with you. I'm on the same page as you, zero tolerance. And I'll tell you why. And you can probably say much more on this topic. And that is that after speaking to over 45,000 people in 20 years, I have seen that it may start with marijuana, but then it turns into death. So many children, young adults, are dying from drug overdose in the from community. Hashem Yirachem, Hashem Yishmar. So many started years ago with weed, and today they're not here anymore. They've been I was told 11 deaths in 5 weeks. I mean,
Frightening.
I have no words, only tears. I have no words to say anything. How can anybody have anything to say on 11 kids overdosing, dying from trauma, being thrown out of school, and other issues that starts with weed, marijuana, pot,
Yep.
all the same?
That's right. And it's not that the subject of gateway drugs has not been looked at before. There are books on this, there's textbooks on it, written by experts from 30, 30, 35, 40 years ago, who are recognizing that many of these drugs are gateway drugs, that even if you want to poo-poo them, but it's basically a stepping stone to something that's even more serious. I can't tell you how many times I've had people sitting in my office here arguing, yeah, but the marijuana, it's legal and you can't overdose on it. And I said, who's talking about overdose from that? I'm talking about the impaired judgment that people have when the brains can no longer function normally because they're smoking it, and whether they're under the influence of quote unquote the high right now, or the brain changes that follow it that impair their judgment and their reaction time for who knows how long later, it's serious. And there's nobody to talk to. I remember there was one case, this is actually a case I think Mask was involved in the referral, where we wound up discovering that the parents of this kid, it was a young teenager who was smoking marijuana very heavily. And it turned out that the parents were like very laissez-faire about it. The father was probably not involved to the best of my knowledge, as I'm recalling, this is a long time ago. And the mother was actually providing alcohol in her home to teenagers of all ages because, oh, if I give them beer over here, then they're not going to go do heroin somewhere else. And she was violating the law openly. And it turned out there were a number of professionals in the field who were aware of that. The family moved out of town. I have no idea where they even went to. We can't follow it up. But the kid was coming in to me, and I was trying to make a referral to a residential program. This kid needed one badly. And I do think that I have the experience to judge when somebody needs a more intensive treatment level. And the parents were supposed to have met with me that day. Instead, they sent the older sister, who's very close with this kid. All right, this is a last-minute change. And the girl sits down in my office and says, "Why are you sending my brother to rehab?" I said, "Why not?" They said, "He only smokes marijuana." I said, "So therefore?" And she says, "Well, you know that the problem with marijuana, they made it illegal only because they can't tax it, and it's the government's way of being able to." I said, "Stop that argument. That is so full of holes. It's so ridiculous. When people are desperate to try to protect themselves, they're going to come up with some of the silliest kinds of defenses." But this was the word in the street. In the street, they said, "Yes, marijuana is wonderful and it's fine, and there's people who function on it very well, yada, yada, yada. And at the end of the day, it's illegal and it shouldn't be." And unfortunately, that's where legislatures have taken it in too many places because it's horrible.
Yeah, Dr. Torsky, can we talk about the issue of fentanyl laced in the drugs today, please?
Drugs these days have gone, things have come full circle. Many years ago, when I was first getting introduced into the addiction field, while there were street drugs, the drugs that were most common, I'm talking back to the late 60s, mostly the early 70s, many of the druggies that were addicted were using pills. And it was fairly simple to manipulate the medical system to get access to it. Over all those years, the states have taken the issue of drugs a lot more seriously. And they made all sorts of arrangements to make the prescribing of the controlled substances much more difficult. So that if a doctor was going to give sleeping pills or anti-anxiety medication or pain medication, it had to be in this kind of a form or triplicates, or it had to be registered with the state or whatever. They began doing that. While that was a little bit limiting, it did not plug the leak well enough. However, in the meantime, a lot of street drugs became a lot cheaper, a lot easier to get access to. The difference between the prescribed drugs and the street drugs is that street drugs, you have no idea, percentage-wise, what you're getting. So that if somebody buys a bag of heroin, they can believe that it's, quote, I'm making up the numbers, 10% pure. You have no way to know that it's 10% pure. It could be 60%. It could be 3%. You have no way to know. And over the years, there have been several episodes where there was a batch of a drug that came into the street market that was either tainted or it was very, very different, that it had this drug instead of that drug, which is many times more powerful. And there were overdoses all over the place. I was working in New Jersey at the time, and the location of the hospital where I was working, we had one of the largest supplies of Narcan in the United States, just because we were getting these cases of people who had overdosed on what they thought was a bag of heroin. There was a single bag, which was what this person's habit was. But it turned out that the powder that was in it was 20 some times more powerful, just because of the nature of that of the substance, and they died of overdoses in their cars. The cops were walking by with flashlights up and down the block. If they saw what looked like somebody sleeping in their car, they would break the glass open and pull them out. These were horrible things. So the quality of what you're getting on the street was not predictable, and it was not reliable. That continued, the cocaine market was that way, the heroin market was that way, and all of these, and of course the market for methamphetamine, these are all street-produced drugs. The trend swung from there back to the opiate painkillers. So the ones, the names that were very popular were Percocet and Vicodin and OxyContin, and there were several others, Tylenol with codeines. The problem was that these were controlled substances. You were guaranteed of the quality because it's pharmaceutically manufactured. And the states began to make it very difficult to get access to them. Now what we're watching is a trend to go back to the street drugs. And heroin is taking a very, very big place there. And what's happening on the street as a result of an uncontrolled situation is we have a lot of accidental overdoses. I'm not even getting into the suicidal overdoses that people are doing it intentionally. That's as much of a mental health issue. But the risk of overdose just by buying street drugs is a very, very serious risk. These are not people who are intending to take their own lives. They're just intending to continue doing whatever they had been doing. And we're watching these kids, unfortunately, way, way, way too many statistically. Even one is too many. But statistically, it's crazy.
One is too many for Claudius Rowe to lose. One. And yeah. So many kids are dying by accidental death. A lot of them also, Dr. Torsky, if you could address the issue of when they go into rehab and they're there for as long as their professional does placement with them or they choose to stay, which is a whole nother complicated conversation where we want them to stay minimum 90 days and sometimes 6 months, a year, depending. Every case is different, and an addiction therapist needs to assess prior to placing them into a rehab. Parents should not pick a rehab. We need addiction therapists to do that after they meet the client. But the question is, what happens when they come out and they relapse? Why are a lot of these young people overdosing and dying because they relapse, and the amount of drugs they're taking when they relapse? Could you explain to our listeners what happens when someone goes in taking 20 Xanax or opiates, whatever it may be, prior to going into a rehab, coming out, being clean, being in therapy, going to 12-step meetings, rebuilding their life, and then relapse? What are the dangers?
The dangers are very obvious, but let's look at this from a couple of different angles. Angle number one: when somebody has been in a treatment situation, they're in an environment which is controlled, they're okay remaining clean and sober in an environment like that. What really needs to happen is some sort of a step-down process during which they can learn how to manage in a less controlled environment until being reintroduced into the world where they were raised, where they're going to go back to. So it really needs to happen more gradually. One of the elements that makes that difficult is insurance. Every program costs money, you know, and believe me, I have yet to meet somebody who got rich running a program like this. So it's not like they're sitting around and they're sponging off a lot of money, but there's cost to this. The health insurance market is very difficult with these things. You know, their attitude is just say no, and it's easy to tell somebody to just say no, but for somebody who's been an addict, it's a lot harder for them to say no. So on one hand, the going from the treatment environment back to the environment at home and in the street is a drastic change that needs to have been prepared for better. And it isn't that I'm faulting the rehabs on this. There are programs that exist for this, but they cost, and nobody wants to pay for it. Parents, by the time they've put a kid into a rehab, have probably spent a little fortune on them at that point. So, you know, unless they're coming from tremendous wealth, you know, the resources aren't there. There's a second thing. The second thing is that let's go back to the example that you gave, where a kid came into the rehab doing 20 Xanax per day. Let's say the kid during this period of time of, you know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, has broken the physical dependency. Their tolerance for the drug has gone back down to where it would be pretty close to what your average person would be, who has never had any kind of dependency. Now, it's not a drug that I've ever used, to the best of my knowledge. You know, and I mean, in terms of medication, of course. But I would guess that one Xanax would probably knock me off my feet. Because I have no tolerance for it. And that would be doing probably what it's intended to do. For somebody who has developed a tolerance to it, one is not going to do that for them. They're not going to get that high. So they'll do two, they'll do three. And this is an individual in the in our little story here who's worked his way up to 20. Now, when he's in the rehab for a month, 2 months, or whatever, he's walking back out zero with no tolerance anymore. Is this individual going to take, if he's going to relapse, is he going to take one or is he going to take 20? Much more likely to take 20 to go back to his old dose. The problem that there is that without the tolerance, that's an overdose.
So, and that's what's been happening to many of the young adults that Clyusrell is losing from an overdose.
Right.
It's that they went back to an original amount that their memory reminded them of prior to going inpatient.
Right. Now, there's a third angle on this, which is as important as the other two. That is where somebody has been in a treatment environment, and even let's assume that the person really invested themselves with a major effort. I want to clean my act. I want to live a solid, normal life. They work really hard at it. There's a reality, and that is that they have to distance themselves and put all sorts of prevention measures into their lifestyle that's going to prevent them from relapse. And that means not just, you know, not just holding the drug in their hand, but not coming close to it either. And for any given 100 people who have had this problem, there's going to be 100 different strategies that they have to use in order to distance themselves and protect themselves. Well, what happens is that when somebody encounters the kind of challenge that they will slip, you know, it isn't that they slip by taking just one either, but even if they do that, they say they will turn to themselves, and this is more of a psychological thing. I worked so hard at staying clean, and darn, I blew it. I messed it up. That feeling of having failed at recovery and sobriety leads people to say, all right, I'm going to throw the towel in completely. So that what after having relapsed, but they relapsed on one, which they could pick themselves up by the bootstraps, reach out for help, do whatever, use their fellowship from the 12-step rooms. They can have a therapist, a sponsor. There's dozens of options that people can have. But hopefully they would employ these. But if they don't, there's a risk that they're going to turn and say, I flunked, I blew it, I can't do it, I give up, and they lose all of their motivation to remain in recovery and to remain drug free just because of a little goof. And this takes them right back to the 20 Xanax or whatever else it was. So there's three angles on this, and all three are relevant. And I mean, I've personally watched cases of all of these things happening. You know, people going back to a dose that they could not tolerate medically. I've watched people be thrown into environments that they're just not ready for. And I've watched people just walk in, you know, they have the slightest little thing, and then they, I just give up. I can't do it. And they put themselves at terrible, terrible risk.
Yeah, this is a whole nother show that we can go on and talk about. I'd love you to come on again, Rabbi Dr. Tversky. Tonight, we have Rabbi Ben-Zion Tversky, Dr. Ben-Zion Tversky. It's hard to remember that I need to use both Rabbi Doctor always when I address you, so I'm sorry. But I want to thank you for being on our show this evening. 718-758-0400. And you can call from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. if you want to reach Dr. Tversky, 718-437-4118. Thank you, Dr. Tversky.